The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. During the course of the next 2 hours, we're going to look at a number of things happening in foreign policy and intelligence work with the United States. Next hour, we'll be taking to the Congo to talk about what's going on in the Congo. We don't talk much about that. In the first hour, we're going to talk about Yemen, the attacks in Afghanistan, the deaths of CIA officers, intelligence work, and whether there's a contradiction with our war in Afghanistan and Iraq and more with our guests. Stay tuned for that. Before we get to all that, let's get you home safe and turn this over to WEAA Traffic. We'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna. Information on flooring available at luna.com/traffic or 877-241-LUNA.
Northbound 95, busiest from 895 to the Beltway with this update brought to you by Advil. On the inner loop of the Beltway, it's heaviest coming off of 95 in the southwest corner up towards Liberty Road. And again from Green Spring Avenue to the 83s. Chopper Road at Delaware Avenue for a crash in Towson. Baltimore City accidents include St. Paul at Mount Royal, Saratoga at Fremont, and Utah at Fayette. Get the facts and join millions who count on Advil for relief. Relief doesn't get any better than this. Advil. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We have all seen the news, of course, about what happened in Afghanistan, where seven CIA officers and one intelligence officer from Jordan were blown up by someone they thought was one of their operatives, who turned out to be a double agent for Al-Qaeda. We've seen what happened with the plane to Detroit and all the commotions around that. And there have been many articles written about what this says about our intelligence policy, what it says about this war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and whether some people are positing that this is you can't do both, that the war in Afghanistan and Iraq are actually taking away from our larger security interests. Is that true? How do we respond to this? And it, of course, is something probably one of the most serious things facing President Barack Obama in his year-long presidency. We are joined in studio by Sam Faddis. His most recent book is called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He's president of Orion Strategic Services, a consulting firm providing training in areas of counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and weapons of mass destruction. He is a retired CIA ops officer. We're joined in the first part of this program, first half an hour, by Phyllis Bennis, who joins us once again. She is author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. When we come back from the half an hour break, Phyllis will be leaving, and we'll be joined by Juan Cole, author of the book Engaging the Muslim World. Sam Faddis will be with us for the entire hour. Number here is 410-319-8888. And Phyllis Bennis and Sam Faddis, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Phyllis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us here, and Sam as well.
Good to be here.
So let's take a look first at what has happened in the news in the last couple of weeks and what it says to both of you in terms of where our intelligence and foreign policy decisions are, and the collision of those two policies, of those two worlds, with what happened in Afghanistan and also what's happening at the Detroit airport. Let me start with our phone guest, Phyllis Bennis.
Well, I think what we're seeing, if we needed any more reminders, is the absolute failure of war as a strategy to stop terrorism. Somehow it seems that people in power in this country and elsewhere understand that paying ransom, for instance, can sometimes breed more terrorism. But they don't get it that going to war in response to an act of terrorism doesn't stop terrorism. It breeds more. I think we have to be careful. I mean, this most recent attack, if we're saying that we are at war in Afghanistan, which the actions of the U.S. military would certainly indicate, I don't think we correctly use the term terrorism when we speak of, for example, this attack in a military base, a U.S. military base in Afghanistan that led to the deaths of seven intelligence agents. That's an act of war in a war that the U.S. is waging in somebody else's country. It's not an act of terrorism, which means it was an attack on non-combatants and civilians. These were combatants. Tragic, no doubt, but this is the consequence of using war as an instrument to stop terrorism. The fact that we are now hearing about the possibility of expanding this war even further, perhaps against Yemen, is a frightening possibility, that the lessons of history simply are being ignored. The lessons that say you cannot use the weapon of war as an instrument that's going to stop individual acts of terrorism somewhere else.
I'm going to take two things you said and ask Sam to respond. Let me start with what you just said, fellas, about the use of language and how we describe things. And we describe things as terrorism. It's interesting you said that, fellas, and I was reading in one article today that one of the young men who grew up in Washington, D.C., who's on trial in Pakistan, said, "You can't call us terrorists," he was saying as he was being led to court. "We're not terrorists. We're jihadists. We're fighting a war." And I was juxtaposing that to what you just said, Phyllis, and Sam, language is very important here. I mean, how do you view it?
Well, I think that terrorism is a tactic, and I think people who have correctly pointed out that calling this a global war on terror have that's not a particularly helpful term on a whole bunch of levels. To that extent, I would probably agree with at least on some level with this individual we were talking about in Pakistan. I mean, the basis of what he's doing is he's engaging in jihad. I mean, if he chooses to practice terrorism, in other words, attacks on civilian targets and that kind of thing, that's an instrument. That's a mechanism he's using.
But what happened in Afghanistan with men and women you may have known or not known because of your work with the CIA was then that not really an act of terrorism. It was an act of what he saw as war, because he was not attacking civilians. He was attacking an intelligence military outpost.
Well, I'm sure you could make that case, although I think the fundamental issue would be, if we're talking about Al-Qaeda, I mean, whether on any particular occasion they're choosing to attack a military target or not a military target. I mean, it's clearly an organization that has embraced terrorist tactics, attacked civilian targets, killed thousands of people who cannot possibly be defined as combatants. So they attack a CIA base, they attack a military patrol on some particular instance. I don't think that changes their fundamental nature.
I think, though, that I would just add one point to that. I think that Sam is right, that the nature of Al-Qaeda we've seen is an organization that's willing to attack civilians. I don't think that we can say yet that this was Al-Qaeda that carried out this attack. The fact that they claimed it afterwards, to me, doesn't mean much. I think terrorist organizations are prepared to claim credit for all kinds of things, whether they do them or not. And I think the part of the reality in Afghanistan is the U.S. is waging a war, not a tactic, a war in Afghanistan against all kinds of people in Afghanistan who don't like them being in their country, occupying their country, and waging war in their country. Who carried out that attack? Not clear. We're hearing more and more that this particular individual who had been recruited by Jordanian intelligence and had flipped and was acting as a double agent. Whoever he was accountable to, if he was accountable to anybody as opposed to just himself, I don't think we really know that yet. So I think that the question of who was involved, we have to be a little bit cautious about when we get this information. We've been hearing for the last several months about how there are really only about 100 Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, maybe another 300 in Pakistan, a few hundred perhaps in Yemen. But all of a sudden now we're hearing the opposite, that suddenly now we're saying Al-Qaeda is powerful enough to infiltrate the Jordanian intelligence operations, to potentially flip an agent of the CIA. So I think that a lot of this is designed to scare people and to make it seem to justify anything that the U.S. militarily might do.
So, let's explore that a minute. I mean, I think this is a really interesting point you raised, Phyllis. And Sam, so from your perspective, what's going on here? I mean, in terms of what we think we're fighting outside of Afghanistan and Iraq right now, but I mean, which I think maybe you can even, you know, you can't go outside of Afghanistan and Iraq because it's wrapped up in the war for Obama's policies and for Bush's policies, really. So I mean, what from Phyllis was saying, what are we fighting here?
Well, you know, I think that's a really excellent question because I think it's not just a question of what are we fighting, but, you know, to take a line from the old song, what are we fighting for? Like, what exactly are the objectives here? Who are we opposed to and what exactly are we looking to achieve? If we are looking to defeat Al-Qaeda, which I would submit to you is leaving aside for a moment the question of what defeat means, but that's fundamentally got to be part of what we're doing. We can transform Afghanistan into a paradise tomorrow, which obviously is not going to happen. And that's not going to defeat Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's a worldwide organization, and it's active in Europe, and it's active all over the place. So I do agree that there's way too much emphasis on conventional means and conventional war, and as if we can force these guys to the battlefield and we can confront them. And in Afghanistan, we ought to be thinking very hard about what our objective is, because if our objective there is we're going to transform that place into a Western-style liberal democracy and a functioning nation state, then we better be prepared to stay there for probably generations, not 18 months.
So let's talk about what we think America should be doing here. I mean, we've seen over the last year since the U.S. coal was hit that the folks accused of doing that in Yemen have either escaped or been allowed to leave Yemen. We've seen our war in Iraq, which, as Senator Feingold was saying from the beginning, has nothing to do with this war on terrorism. It's going to just take us away from our larger objectives. We're in Afghanistan, putting more troops in there. We've seen CIA officers being killed in Afghanistan. So what should be our response? I mean, we're seeing now people like Senator Lieberman saying that we should go into Yemen. I mean, how many more countries can we attack? So the question is, we are at a real critical juncture here in terms of figuring out how America responds to everything that's happened since 9/11. And I think that's the debate America has to have, Phyllis Bennison. So talk about where you think that debate needs to start.
Well, I think we need to start in looking at what actually threatens the United States. We have been attacked by terrorists. 9/11 was the classic example of that. In other countries around the world, people have been attacked by terrorists, generally on a smaller scale, but far more frequently with huge numbers over the years of civilian casualties. And I think, you know, it's a bit sobering for us in this country, having been for so long the sole superpower, as we like to say, that can get away with anything in the world, to imagine what would happen if every country that was attacked by individual or small group terrorist actions felt that they then had the right to go to war anywhere in the world that terrorist may have traveled to, may have gone to language school, may have visited, may have come from, whatever. We would have a world at war far more than we do now. I mean, imagine, for example, Cuba, where for years there have been terrorist elements in Miami, for instance, that the U.S. has known about and during some periods have supported, during other periods have simply stood mute while they carried out their terrorist activities in Cuba. Imagine what if Cuba decided that they, because the U.S. wasn't doing anything to stop it, they had the right to send drone missiles into Miami to go after these terrorists. I mean, imagine what the result would be, what the response would be, what the view of international law would be. The American exceptionalism that tells us that when we are attacked, somehow we have the right to do anything, anywhere in the world, I think is at the root of much of this failed strategy. Acknowledging that something, whether it's Somalia, whether it's parts of Yemen, are what U.S. officials like to call failed states, meaning that governments don't function the way they should or the way we would like them to, doesn't give us the right to invade. It doesn't mean it's okay to send drone missiles. The fact of terrorism has been a fact of life in the second half of the 20th century and now into the 21st century at various levels in various countries. It's not something that happened for the first time on September 11th, 2001. And I think part of the problem is we operate as if we are the only country in the world and that our people are the only people who have rights, that only our people can be protected. That's even before we get to the even if questions. Even if going to war in Iraq would keep us safe, put aside that we know there was no connection to terrorism, there was no connection to 9/11, there were no weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, but even if that would have kept some people in the U.S. safe, would that have made it okay to have almost a million people die as a result of that war? You know, we don't take those considerations nearly seriously enough, and I think that's what our debate has to look at. And the final point, I think, is that we have to look at the costs to ourselves as well as to the world. If we are serious, as President Obama, I think, is, about real health reform, about green jobs, about protecting the environment, none of those programs stands a chance. All of them will collapse as Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs collapsed in the quagmire of Vietnam. The equivalent of in healthcare, jobs, the environment will collapse under Obama when the money is sucked up in a hopeless, failing war in Afghanistan, and God forbid, an expanded war into Yemen or anywhere else.
Phyllis Bennis is author of the book Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Sam Faddis' most recent book is called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He's a retired CIA ops officer who is first on here about his book, Hotel California, about his experiences in Iraq before the war started. 410-319-8888 is the number here. To join us, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So we are really, I'm going to go back to where we started up, where Phyllis left off, and this whole idea of where we are in the world and what we should be doing. I mean, when you were sent to Iraq, and before you could even finish your work, you were told that a war that wasn't going to start was starting. And then you see people in the CIA who were killed in Afghanistan. I mean, what are your thoughts about where this policy is going? And I mean, your book, latest book, which I need to read, which I have not read, I'm looking forward to read to get on the show, which is The CIA, which is a Beyond Repair, fit that into this conversation.
Well, I think that we ought to be considerably more cautious about where we're getting involved, but particularly militarily. I agree wholeheartedly with that. I also agree when we're just talking about this struggle, if we can throw that label on it with Islamic radicalism, that this is really something that needs to be resolved on a lot of levels other than military or intelligence. I mean, it has economic and political and social and cultural components. And I think particularly this resort to conventional military means to try to resolve these things is very counterproductive. Having said all of that, I think at the end of the day, when we have done that and acted with restraint and I certainly don't think invading Yemen is the answer to anything, I think at the end of the day you're going to find that there are still individuals out there who are enemies of the United States. And unfortunately, the reality is we're going to have to go find a way to deal with them by harsh measures. So and back, you know, I think the answer to that is probably intelligence work and special operations forces. And I don't say that because it sounds cool or sexy or because anybody ought to think that's a neat, attractive solution. But unfortunately, I think you're going to find that there remain places on the globe where these guys can operate and the local governments are not going to cooperate with us. And I don't think we want to be in a position where we sit here and say, fine, we're just simply going to tolerate their presence and wait for them to come attack us.
So the question is, I still want to pose to both of you, is what do we do then? I mean, if Phyllis, if for argument's sake, we say the war in Iraq was an absolute mistake, and most people, I think, agree with that,
right,
that adding more into Afghanistan could sink us deeper into a mud of a war that no Western nation has ever won when they stepped into Afghanistan, mm-hmm, for numerous reasons. And you have the world that we face, the part of the reality is the Taliban is very different than the Al-Qaeda,
right,
different organizations. But there are organizations, whether run by al-Qaeda, and I don't have to know whether or not, or whether they have kind of dispersed around the Western world and the Islamic world into groups of people who do have an agenda to topple Muslim governments, to attack the West as well. There has to be some kind of response. You have to be able to protect yourself.
Right. The question is, what actually will protect lives, protect U.S. lives, and protect other people's lives, which are equally important to our own? Because, again, around the world, Americans have been among the least targeted for terrorist attacks if we look back over the last, say, quarter century. The exception of 9/11 was precisely that the horrificness of it was precisely because it was such a large scale on one day. But for many people in so many countries, this is a huge reality, and it's absolutely right that we need to figure out ways to deal with it. I think we need to separate the organizational reality. I absolutely agree with what Sam said a few minutes ago about Afghanistan, that if Afghanistan turned into paradise overnight, if it turned into Switzerland, not that Switzerland is such a paradise these days, but let's use, turned into Sweden overnight, I don't know if Sweden's done anything bad lately, we would still have al-Qaeda. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But what's also true is that if Afghanistan turned into a paradise overnight, what we would not have is the vast majority of people willing to support al-Qaeda. And without that vast support, the ability to do what they are doing would be enormously reduced. So that's step one. That's where the policy changes matter. I think it's true that changing our policy of the kind of American exceptionalism that allows us to invade anybody, the use of these drones without accountability for civilian deaths, uncritical support for Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid policies, all of that, changing all of that would not reverse the views of al-Qaeda, but it would reverse the views of the masses of people in so many countries that think that at the end of the day, I don't like it, but maybe what they're doing isn't such a bad idea. Maybe I'd be willing to help them out because they're better than the alternative, which is the U.S. and the CIA running rampant through our countries. That's what could change. So that has to be part of the equation. Then there's the issue of what kind of aid we supply. There's the Yemen story. I haven't been able to get out of my mind the fact that the U.S. has just announced that they're sending $70 million in military and intelligence aid to the government of Yemen. That's the exact same amount of aid that was cut in 1990. The U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world, which at the time was only $70 million, because Yemen had the temerity to vote no in the UN resolution in the Security Council when the U.S. was trying to get support for its then war against Iraq, Operation Desert Storm. Yemen was one of only two countries that voted no, and there was an American ambassador at his side a half second later who said to the Yemeni ambassador, Abdullah El-Ashtal, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. Mm. And the remark was picked up on an open mic and broadcast throughout the UN and quickly around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget, $70 million. What if we had not cut that aid? What if instead we had flooded Yemen with money, not just to the government, but to create clinics and doctors and money to the people of Yemen? You think that there would be this kind of anti-Americanism there now? I don't think so.
Sam, the point Phyllis raises, then I go to the phones here and get these callers calling in. I was on a phone call to some Palestinians, both in Israel and in the parts of Palestine and West Bank and in Gaza. And there was this march that took place the other day. And what people don't realize is that the vast majority of Palestinians wanted to make this march from Gaza City to the Israeli border. A nonviolent, they signed, 50,000 signatures signed a petition saying we would walk nonviolently to the border of Israel. But when the Hamas government got involved, many people backed out and didn't want to be part of it because they were trying to make an independent march. We only just covered the Westerners trying to get in from Egypt to Gaza. We didn't cover the Gazans themselves who were actually doing this. And there's a point here to something we're missing in the Muslim world that we're totally missing, and Villas was, I think, touching on that.
Well, there's no question that there are a number of things that we have been doing over the there's the Arab-Israeli conflict, and then there are specific actions on the part of the United States that have certainly not had a positive impact on the way people are looking at the United States and have or certainly been counterproductive. I mean, look, we need to get out of Iraq. We're in the process, I think, of doing that. We've talked ad nauseum about that whole chapter and how we got dragged down that road, myself included. We need to figure out what our goal is in Afghanistan. I mean, we did not, let's be brutally honest, we didn't go to Afghanistan after September 11th because we went there to free the people and for women's rights and all this other stuff. That's I'm not disparaging any of those, but that's not why we went there. We went there out of pure national interest because we'd been attacked.
We went for revenge.
Right. Well, we've now taken on a whole series of additional tasks without really, I think, anybody ever sitting down and focusing on what's involved there. I would suggest in Afghanistan, unless the American people are really willing to make an investment that I don't think anybody on earth wants to make in terms of blood and treasure, that we need to set some much more realistic goals, you know, and accept that when we withdraw our troops from there, it's still not going to be a particularly pleasant place, and it's going to be arguably a nation, and there's still going to be a lot of violence. But the longer we have troops on the ground there, there's a certain counterproductive aspect to that. You know, Teddy Roosevelt used to talk about the speaking softly and carrying the big stick, and over the years people have sort of transformed that into kind of him just being rather bellicose and running around the world. But if you really look at the way he talked and he amplified that policy, you know, most of his emphasis was actually on the fact that before you get involved in armed conflict, you ought to really think about what you're doing and look for every other alternative before you do that. And we would do well to think about it in those terms.
Let me open the phones here before we go to break. 410-319-8888. DeConte in Greenmount, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Thank you for calling.
Three quick points I want to make. One is, I think, you know, we need to think about the root causes, of a lot of the negative attitudes. One is the Israeli, Palestinian issue. I just heard over the radio a couple of months, the Condoleezza Rice made 23 trips to that region and, with no results. People can see that, there's not some real sincere effort made, to try to resolve that. The next thing, right now, they have a whole list now, of bad countries. I'm originally from West Africa, Liberia. Now, Nigeria is on that list. Why is Nigeria on that list? You didn't fly in from Nigeria. That's another component. The last thing is, the war in Afghanistan, it's just really, really funny because we're spending all this money to keep Al-Qaeda on the run. That don't make a lot of sense. What if the mayor of, Baltimore, wanted to spend, millions of dollars, to keep the drug dealers on the run. We will laugh about that, right? Thank you very much.
Thank you, DeConte. Phyllis, you want to pick up that before you take off? I know you have to leave at the break.
I do. I just think, I think that the caller is right, that there's an arbitrariness to each of these responses. This particular attack on Christmas Day, which luckily was stopped before anyone was hurt, except for the would-be bomber, was a coincidence in a sense that he happened to be Nigerian. He had been studying in the UK. In fact, when we hear today that the U.S. is now putting together a list of 14 countries, all of the Muslim countries, with the exception of Cuba, why Cuba's on that list, I think we know the answer, but it really sort of puts in perspective how arbitrary this is, how politically motivated this is, rather than being based on where are the countries that the people who have attacked us are actually coming from. If we look at 9/11, that would be Germany, and that would be Florida and Minnesota. That's where these people were living and studying and going to flight school. The recent one, this guy that tried to attack the Northwest flight from Amsterdam, I hold that very personally because I take that flight all the time, was studying in the UK. It would really be Britain would be the top of the list if you were going to look at a list of where these people are coming from. So there's this politicization of it, and it comes out with a racist edge against Arabs, South Asians, and other Muslims that I think is what is felt so profoundly around the world. We hear of people, when I travel internationally, I hear all the time about people who no longer want
to come to the U.S. to study, for tourism, to visit. They no longer want their children to study here. They don't want their children to have to go through what they know people go through at our airports. And you know what? It hasn't kept us safe. That's the bottom line. These symbolic gestures that seem so clearly designed to make Americans feel like the government is doing something to protect them, when they end up not keeping us safe and antagonizing people all around the world. It's the, at the end of the day, it's this question of what is it going to take to stop terrorism? We know what doesn't work. War as a strategy to stop the tactic of terrorism simply doesn't work. We need a different strategy that starts with understanding why it is that people have this willingness to support these kinds of acts. We have to look at what our policies are. We have to look at the root causes. The caller who mentioned root causes is absolutely right. That's the fundamental. And when we put ourselves in a position of saying, if you talk about root causes, you're apologizing for these actions, then we're doomed to fail. We are doomed to fail. We will not be able to stop these kinds of attacks until we look at the root causes.
Phyllis Bennis, it's always a pleasure to have you on our airwaves. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
She's written the book Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll come back with Sam Faddis and tackle the question of what just happened in Afghanistan, what went wrong, and why did that take place? Stay with us at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite welcomes the new decade with a second annual Breakthroughs issue, highlighting 10 simple ideas that could change the city. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations, and you can visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. Joining me in studio is Sam Faddis. His most recent book is called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He's president of the Orion Strategic Services, a consulting firm providing training in areas of counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and weapons of mass destruction. He's a retired CIA ops officer. We'll be joined in a few minutes here by also Juan Cole, who's author of the book, Engaging the Muslim World. And we'll introduce him to you as soon as he joins us. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Sam, tell me what happened. From your perspective in Afghanistan, what between the Jordanian secret intelligence services, who obviously got this guy and said, and he could help. The CIA clearly was involved in that too. What do you think happened here? I know you'll answer this carefully because you work in the past, but what do you think happened here?
As I understand it, there's the qualifier. This individual was dispatched to penetrate the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, in other words, with the idea of operating inside of them and gaining their trust, and then apparently came to meet with officers of the CIA and turned out obviously to be working against us, against the CIA, and was wearing a suicide vest, and which he apparently detonated inside the CIA facility. So, you know, what happened? Well, clearly at some point or another, he entered into the employ of the opposition. Whether that was true from the very beginning or whether, in fact, at some point in the operation, he was detected and turned. In other words, they realized who he was working for and essentially made him an offer he couldn't refuse. I don't know. I mean, This guy transformed at some point into what you would call in intelligence circles a double agent, somebody we think we're running but is really being run against us.
So, but that must mean that there's some greater level of sophistication with Al-Qaeda or people who are associated with Al-Qaeda than we either knew about or that we were clear that they were that sophisticated. Because you think of them as this group on the run, but a group on the run would have a difficult time making these kind of operations work, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I guess I find it a little mysterious why people consider Al-Qaeda to somehow be finished or done with, or somehow to now be lacking in capability. I think part of this maybe boils down to an American tendency to just not have a very long, not much of an attention span. It's been X number of years, so therefore this thing must be resolved, right? We must be ready to move on. These guys are extremely clever. If you look at the attacks that they have staged all over the world, some of them are incredibly sophisticated and very, very clever in the sense of looking for openings and using our strengths against us and capitalizing on that. I mean, that's 9/11, using our entire hijack policy against us to seize those aircraft. So it doesn't really surprise me that they're capable of this at all. And when you operate in that kind of environment, you should operate in a way where effectively you trust nobody. I mean, in other words, you don't ever have a source, and because you've been running him for a certain period of time in this environment, you now consider, well, he's a good guy, he's ours, and therefore we don't have to protect ourselves. I mean, unfortunately, you don't get that luxury, or this kind of thing happens. You just have to maintain your tradecraft and discipline.
Well, what about the relationship between the Jordanian intelligence and the United States, the CIA?
Well, I mean, the Jordanians are great allies of the United States, and they're extremely competent people, but everybody can get fooled and everybody can be had. And I don't think the fact that this guy is working with the Jordanians should have made no difference whatsoever in how he was treated. In other words, if you're going to bring him into an installation, whatever security procedures you have should apply. And if that upsets the Jordanians, it upsets the Jordanians. That's too bad. But in other words, you just either have procedures and you have guidelines and you have the discipline to follow them, or what happens is people die.
We are joined here. Sam Faddis is in the studio. His most recent book is called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He's a retired CIA ops officer. His original book, Hotel California, was how we met and talked about his work, clandestine work inside of Iraq before the war began in Iraq. We are now joined on the phone by Juan Cole, who is one of this country's leading experts on the Muslim world, the Islamic world, speaks multiple languages from that region, and is author of the book Engage in the Muslim World, and writes every day on this. Juan, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
So, Juan, give us your take on the. And I was reading what you wrote about what happened in Afghanistan, but also you kind of really broaden the scope of that thing and connecting all these points that we're looking at. But talk for a minute about what you think is going on in Afghanistan and what happened.
Well, obviously, what happened is that the CIA is doing counterterrorism in the Northwest Frontier areas and the federally administrated tribal areas of Pakistan, as well as in some eastern Pashtun provinces itself. They're using these drone attacks to target individuals. Well, how do they know where the individuals are? How do they track them down? It's by developing local informants, and so they happened to have developed somebody who was a double agent and who probably fed them misinformation for some time before he then detonated a suicide vest, which very cleverly then had the effect of burning their fingers and making it more difficult for them to deal with high-level assets in the future.
We started talking about the before you came on. Phyllis Bennis was with us from the Institute for Policy Studies, and Sam was with us in that first half hour as well. By the way, folks, number here is 410-319-8888. We'll take your calls as they come in. And Dave, we're going to come to your call in just a minute, but I want to get Juan kind of warm up here with us and throw out his thoughts. I mean, when you look at what's going on in Afghanistan right now, you wrote really an interesting piece in the early part of your last piece that you wrote yesterday on the demonstrations taking place in Kabul and Jalalabad involving hundreds of students, and then you had some clips from Al Jazeera, which I wish more of us could watch here in the States, because they really have news we're not finding anywhere else. But talk about how that fits into all this and what you see going on in Afghanistan.
Well, it's absolutely shameful that the U.S. media is not covering the fact that there have been fairly significant street demonstrations against the United States in Jalalabad, which is a major eastern Pashtun city, and in Kabul, the capital, mainly organized by students, university students, that were protesting a number of incidents that have occurred in the past 2 weeks, in which the U.S. Either sent a drone strike on the wrong target and killed civilians, including children, or in one incident, it is alleged, it isn't proven, but it is alleged certainly by the Afghans, including the Afghan government, that the U.S. sent in a kind of assassination squad, probably after a group they thought was making roadside bombs, and got the wrong people and executed a bunch of teenagers in school. So the Afghans were outraged. They considered it an atrocity committed on their soil, and that provoked these street demonstrations, which were held not only Wednesday a week ago, but again on Monday. I haven't seen anti-American demonstrations, even of several hundreds like that, in Afghanistan before. And I think this is a sea change, which is very troubling.
I mean, open the phones here and let our listeners join us here. And I have some other questions I want to raise for both of our guests. 410-319-8888. Dave, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark, thanks very much for the show. Phyllis Bennis is a great spokesperson, as is Juan. I've heard them both. But my question was on an incredible article I read in The Nation magazine on, like, 30th of November. Forget the author's name, but he was talking about how U.S. government is spending 10% or 20% of their expenses, something like this, incredible amount of money to the Al-Qaeda people that are protecting our trucking, or at least money from the various companies, private contractors that are carrying a lot of our goods in Kandahar, Helmand, are getting a lot of money. And we know that they're Al-Qaeda. And you wonder, it makes one think, whatever happened to the not paying terrorists any money? And it's just also, secondly, how can we build a foundation, a truly democratic foundation in a country that's so pervaded by corruption? Thank you very much.
I saw that piece, too, and I was wondering whether they would know that they were Al-Qaeda or if they were just Pashtun or close to Taliban. I actually did question the veracity of everything that was in that article. Did you see that article, Juan?
Well, yes, and it is being alleged now that this is being done by some of the NATO troops, like the Italians and so forth as well. I mean, they're not Al-Qaeda. There's virtually no Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. They're Pashtun tribes people, and in order to go through their territory, you have to pay them a toll. And it may be that some of them are allied with what we're calling Taliban, although one of the mistakes that the Americans are making is to lump everybody who doesn't like the Karzai government or doesn't like the U.S. and NATO presence in Afghanistan together as Taliban. There are actually a number of discrete groups that don't always agree with each other. Not all of them are equally favorable to Mullah Omar or to the Taliban, to Al-Qaeda. So, but this is, it's just a fact of life. If you want to truck things through parts of Afghanistan, you've got to pay off the local tribespeople or they'll rob you. It's a lawless place. The way that the U.S. hopes to go forward on this and NATO is to gradually train up several hundred thousand police and military men. There are some provinces of over a million people that have 7,000 police. They just don't have enough police to do the job. And then tribal structures substitute themselves.
So I'm going to go back to where we kind of left off a minute ago. I mean that before Juan joined us, Sam, and continues the discussion about where we go. I mean, I'm not asking you to tell America what our policy should be because it's not your job, but I mean, your thoughts on where we are. I mean, here we face an expanding war in Afghanistan, and it could end well, it could end not end well, it could be a disaster and a quagmire. We see what's going on in the world of the Pashtun, Pakistani government fighting elements of the Taliban, but not all of it, because they don't have enough forces to commit themselves to address it. You've got what's going on in Yemen and Somalia, two countries hugely destabilized. And for years, many people have been saying Al-Qaeda and operatives are in Somalia. We did a show here on this program before we came to WEAA at least 6-7 years ago, where we interviewed people who were Kenyan Somalis living in Kenya who were being recruited by Al-Qaeda or people they thought were Al-Qaeda from Somalia to become members of the organization. This stuff's been going on for a while. So what should be the response here? I mean, how do we, if we seem to think we know what's going on and all of our policies seem to be going against what we think we know, what is going on? I mean, you know, let me start with you, Juan. I mean, with you, Sam, and go to Juan. I mean, in all your years, and you've been writing about the failure of intelligence and the failure of our intelligence community at the moment, after your 20 years at CIA, what is going on here?
Well, I think part of what's going on is we have a tendency to go out and do what we have the capability to do or what we have some bureaucratic imperative to do, vice doing what is actually designed to deal with the problem. So we seem to have a tendency to involve ourselves in conventional military conflicts because we have a superb military and we can go do that. We should get out of Iraq. We should establish some very realistic goals for Afghanistan, keeping in mind that the reason we went there in the first place effectively was to get rid of Al-Qaeda, and therefore I would submit that the only overriding national interest we have is leaving behind a nation that will not tolerate the presence of Al-Qaeda after we're gone. After that, in terms of, we've got to recognize that we're combating a worldwide opponent, and conventional military invasions of every country on the planet with the idea of creating new nation states is just a crazy road to go down. So, you know, where it is possible for us to give economic and political and military support to a country and they can deal with the problem themselves, we ought to do that. And then in certain select instances, I think at the end of the day, when you're all done, you're still going to find that there are a handful of occasions on which we're going to have to go on some level and take care of the job ourselves. We ought to be real careful about that. We ought to do that only when we don't have other good options and when there's an overriding national interest, not just sort of we're going to go do that in every country in the world. And when we do it, we ought to recognize we're going to pay a price. If you're going to do that kind of thing, people will die. Things will get broken. It will cost billions of dollars. You know, it'll be a mess. There is no antiseptic surgical solution at the end of it.
Juan?
I have to say, am puzzled by the entire way of thinking that has gripped Washington, D.C. Al-Qaeda is a small asymmetrical terrorist group. It has to be dealt with by good police work, counterterrorism technique. The idea that you deal with Al-Qaeda by essentially establishing 21st century colonies in places like Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, it's almost like going back to the 20th century when the League of Nations gave mandates in Syria Palestine to France and Britain that people needed to have them form their government, the European powers, and kind of it was they were juveniles that needed to be grown up before that they could stand on their own feet. This kind of it's essentially a kind of neocolonialism. It's just crazy. First of all, people, they're modern people. Afghans may be largely illiterate and they may not be very urbanized, but they're modern people. They live in the 21st century. They have over 50% of Afghans now have cell phones. They have access to high explosives. They're not going to put up with being colonized. And neither are the Yemenis or the Somalis. So this is just it's kind of for the United States to insert itself, you know, in Algeria circa 1954 and have to fight that kind of a war that the French fought for 10 years all over again. And at the end of which, you know, the French were thrown out of Algeria. And you will note that the Americans have essentially been thrown out of Iraq, and they'll be thrown out of these other places. It's not the way to fight counterterrorism, to occupy countries.
It was interesting to read the article the other day, I think it was the New York Times, talking about while we have spending billions of dollars in Afghanistan fighting a war, the Chinese are spending billions of dollars in Afghanistan building the economy, making jobs, and making money. And China, if nothing else, is our biggest economic competitor as a nation state on the planet, holding $800 billion of our U.S. Treasury bonds. I mean, and it doesn't seem that ever gets...
I agree. If we're talking about national security, probably the largest national security issue is that we have now finished a decade where we shipped most of our manufacturing base offshore to China, and we're now grossly in debt to them, and our economy is in sad shape. So the idea that we can afford to continue to undertake these ventures, I think, is kind of crazy.
So, looking at what we've just said about Afghanistan and where we are and the amount of money we're spending there as versus the money we're spending on really protecting ourselves from attack or really understanding how to do that. I mean, before we get into the question of how you reverse change policy and kind of do a different way, I mean, I when you see things, let me just take a digression and want to bring you right back in. I just want to ask Sam Faddis, when you see what they're doing with the TSA at airports, and you said before you think the way we're protecting our borders at this moment is just cockamamie. I mean, what was your reaction when you read that? I mean, and also kind of, and I want to also comment on this too. I mean, they're putting all these Muslim nations on a list of places that we're going to do extra special checks on their nationals coming to America.
Well, I was going to say crazy, but we've used that word too much. Silly. Every time we identify one of these problems, going back to what I said earlier, it seems to me we do what it is easy for us to do. And in this case, we build giant bureaucracies and staff them with lots of people and issue lots of rules and regulations. We still don't have an organization. We now have an organization which spends a lot of time the day after an attack or an attempted attack putting in place all sorts of measures which would have prevented the attack if they had been in place the day before. That's a pointless. I mean, we could all do that. We don't need a bureaucracy to do that. Once the attack has taken place, you know, what we need is an organization which is actually thinking ahead of the problem and is flexible enough to put together some of these things. And a lot of times it's not all that hard. It hasn't been that many weeks since Al-Qaeda utilized almost this exact same technique that they tried in Detroit to try to kill a senior Saudi official. Anybody who's reading the intelligence reports and looking at the news would have that in the context of their interest in liquid explosives ought to have been then looking at their checkpoints and their security procedures and saying, so what's the plan when they try to bring one of those into the United States? Vice waiting till the day after it happened and now implementing all sorts of procedures. The idea of putting X number of countries on a list is also silly. Okay, so the next attack will not come from one of those countries. It'll use a different passport, or the flight will originate in a different location. I mean, that's also kind of goofy.
So, Juan Cole, and going back, I was as someone. I mean, the idea that Americans don't watch Al Jazeera, don't watch kind of the breadth of news that we could in terms of what's really going on. And you've been covering this for so long and doing this for so long. And I wonder sometimes how you kind of keep writing and thinking about these things when you seem like you're hitting kind of an intellectual wall with making people hear it.
Oh, well, I don't worry so much about whether they're hearing it. I lived out in the Muslim world all the way from Cairo to Pakistan for 10 years. And I'm just interested in what goes on there and trying to understand it. And I try to present some analyses of things as I see them. And people benefit from that. That's fine. They don't. I'm not doing it for a huge audience or anything. I've been pleasantly surprised to find a lot of people in the intelligence community do read my essays. A lot of people in government and the military at a fairly high level, reads them. A lot of journalists read them. So for, you know, a Midwest college professor, I find that the Internet has given me a bully pulpit that previous generations of academics really couldn't have dreamed of. There have been months when I've had a million page views, I don't think most academics ever get a million of anything.
Let's talk a bit about Afghanistan. On the throes of what we just saw happen, when we see that the parliament, which is interesting to watch, we very rarely watch the Afghan parliament function. And now we're watching it reject Hamid Karzai's cabinet ministers for lots of complex political, tribal, and other reasons in Afghanistan and the opposition to Hamid Karzai. And you're watching demonstrations. You're watching all the report, reading the reports about we cannot build in any short amount of time a national force in Afghanistan effective enough to deal with what they have to address. If they want to do what you said earlier, which was to leave a country where Al Qaeda would not have a base, which doesn't seem is possible to make happen at the moment. Then, starting with Juan Cole, I mean, how do we begin to parse out our Afghan policy? I mean, we've had this debate on the show the other week with four Afghan citizens, all of whom did want the U.S. out, but in very different ways. Some of them very worried that if the United States leaves now, the Taliban comes in and everything that we're even trying to fight for is over. Others saying you have to leave because you're not going to help Afghan women and the only way we're going to struggle is without you there. So let me start with Juan Cole, where you think this is going, where it should be going.
Well, I think we're essentially involved in a decolonization process in Afghanistan and in Iraq. All decolonization looks pretty similar. The British got out of Kenya, and we forget it was not that long ago, 40 or 50 years ago, that these countries became independent of European colonial empires that had ruled them and established their bureaucracies. So we're playing a similar role now. It's kind of on a faster time scale. But decolonization requires that you have somebody to hand the thing at the end.
So, Juan, I'm sorry, I apologize. I did not see the clock correctly. We're actually out of time. We look forward to having you back as soon as we can.
Okay, great.
Juan Cole, Engaging the Muslim World. Sam Faddis has written the book Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. We look forward to seeing you in the studios again. Thank you all so much for being here. We'll be right back. Stay with us and don't go away.